Well, as the first speaker of the afternoon session, we have the pleasure to welcome Dr. Marco van Leeuwen. He is the current spokesperson of the CERN ALICE experiment, which is the world's largest heavy ion experiment and a flagship experiment at the LHC. Dr. Leeuwen is a researcher at NICEF. He completed his PhD in 2003. And later on, he moved on to the STAR experiment in the United States. And he was physics coordinator at the ALICE experiment before being appointed to the spokesperson position. So please welcome him and looking forward to the talk.
Thank you. Thanks, Dasha, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to tell you a little bit about the research that we do with the ALICE experiment at the LHC. Please bear with me as I try to introduce the field. I think this is probably familiar to many of you, but soon it will get more interesting, I promise. So I just wanted to remind everyone in the room that when we look at matter at atomic scales, the electromagnetic interaction is, of course, the interaction that plays a role. And we heard several talks that focus on electromagnetic interactions. And the field that I work in is the study of the strong interaction. And we normally, at the energies we work, the standard model is really the way to look at matter. So in the standard model, the electromagnetic interaction is mostly carried by the leptons, the electron, the muon, and the tau meson. And the interaction particle is the photon. Now, as you probably know, the corresponding particles for the strong interaction are the quarks, up, down, strange charm, and bottom and top, and the gluon, which is the interaction carrier of the strong interaction. And this is really the dominant interaction when you go to subatomic scales. If you go smaller than the size of the proton or the neutron, which are formed by triplets of quarks. Now, and how do we know that that there are quarks and gluons? Well, quarks were discovered initially with deeply inelastic scattering experiments. But I think these are somehow more easy to understand examples of where quarks and gluons really become apparent. So if you make high energy collisions of electrons and positrons, they annihilate, they form a gluon or a Z boson, which then produces a quark and an antiquark in the most simple type of collisions. And those lead in the detector to very clear signatures like this event, where you see two jets, two sprays of particles, one coming from the quark and the other from the antiquark that is produced in the collision. Now, in these type of this collisions, gluons were discovered. So sometimes you get a three jet event, you get a third parton, a third fundamental quanta, and that is the gluon. And they become very clear in these events or in these events from a different experiment. So at very high energies, quarks and gluons are clearly apparent, although it should be said that we do not see the quarks and gluons in isolation. We see them always after they hadronized, after they formed bound states with pions, kaons, and protons. And this is somehow one of the key features of the strong interaction that is not that is special for the strong interaction and also sometimes not so intuitive. So while, as I said, at very high energies, we see signatures of quarks and gluons in high energy collisions. If we go to low energies, quarks are bound into hadrons. And here on the left, you see a calculation of the potential between a quark and an antiquark as you bring them farther apart. And you find that it's a numerical calculation. And we find that at very small interaction distances, you see a kind of a familiar behavior. It's not exactly 1/r², but something like that. But then at larger distances, you have a linear increase of the potential, which means that the force is constant. And this means that you cannot separate quarks and gluons from each other, and leads that is related to this property of confinement in the strong interaction, which is governed by the running of the coupling constant, which is shown here in the middle panel. Now, so we can now use several approaches to study the strong interaction. And what we do in ALICE is a bit special. So I want to spend one moment introducing that as well. So when you study interactions, you can think of different regimes in which you study the interaction. And what people normally think of as the most simple is when you have free particles that you collide, two-body scattering, like these E plus E minus collisions that they showed earlier. Unfortunately, this is not exactly possible in the strong interaction, although in proton-proton collisions, that is what we do. We use two-body scattering, and that is the same technique in electromagnetism and the strong interaction. Now, if you go to more complex systems in electromagnetism, you would talk about atomic physics. You have bound states. And as you know, there's a whole new set of phenomena that you get when you have bound states. And in the strong interaction, we can do something very similar. And that is basically the field of hadronic and nuclear physics. So this is studying bound states. You can do spectroscopy. You have different types of bound states, different energies, which appear to us as different particles. And similarly, in nuclear physics, we look at bound states of different protons and neutrons. And while we study that in ALICE, and I'll actually show you some examples of that, our focus is really on the condensed matter physics of the strong interaction. So in electromagnetism, condensed matter physics, as you know, there are many aspects. There are thermal and electrical properties. There's, of course, different states, solid states and fluids, superconductivity and all of those things. And in the strong interaction, the state that we can most easily study is the quark-gluon plasma. It's the high temperature state of the strong interaction in which quarks and gluons are kind of free to move around and where the matter forms a fluid that can be compressed and move in a collective way. And I'll try in the first part of the talk to explain to you how we study that matter, how we find that it is indeed a relevant degree of freedom of the theory, and how we can study the properties of that matter. So before going there, I just wanted to still emphasize that when you think of strongly interacting matter, you have two relevant phases. One is the low temperature phase, where quarks and gluons are confined in hadrons, and you have either an atomic nucleus or a hadron gas. So if you heat up a nucleus, you will slowly produce more particles, but they will still, the quarks and gluons will still be bound. And if you go to higher temperatures, at some point you will enter this quark-gluon plasma phase. It's a kind of an ionization process, and that's intuitively understandable, but we also have, again, numerical theory calculations that show that there is such a phase transition. So that's what's shown here in the middle. It's the energy density as a function of temperature. And you see here on the left of the figure a very strong increase of this energy density. We divide by T to the 4 because that's the basic scaling. And that is a sign that there is a phase transition, that the number of degrees of freedom is actually what increases. So it goes from about 3, which are the number of pions, the lightest bound states, to about 40, which are all the quarks and gluons with their color and spin degrees of freedom. And we see a very clear phase transition in the theoretical calculation, and we can produce the high temperature phase and study it in high energy collisions of heavy ions. So we do that at the Large Hadron Collider, which I guess many of you are familiar with. The Large Hadron Collider is the largest particle accelerator collider in the world. And a large part of the year, we collide protons, two beams of protons together. But 1 month a year, more or less, we collide heavy nuclei, most of the time lead ions. And we'll actually start colliding lead ions this Saturday. So we are all very geared up to actually get going again with our experimental program after several upgrades, which I'll discuss a little later in the talk. And the experiment that we work on is the ALICE detector, which is shown here in a picture. It has this typical geometry of detectors surrounding a beam pipe that goes there in the middle of the picture and produces the collisions. Now, this is an example of one event in as measured by our experiment. This is actually was measured last year in a pilot run with our upgraded detector. You see that in a single heavy ion collision, there are thousands of particles. And here at mid-rapidity, we have a whole set of detector systems that measure all these particles. We measure things like the momentum and the types of particles, and we look at their distributions. And then at the forward rapidity, we have a special detector, which is a muon detector. It contains absorbers, which filter out most of the hadrons, most of the the strongly interacting particles, and only the muons, which are specific type of leptons, remain. So that's why here you see much fewer tracks. In reality, there are many particles, but most are absorbed by this absorber. And in the talk, I would like to give you to give you a feeling for how we analyze these collisions to learn about the quark-gluon plasma. And unfortunately, I had a video here which shows you how we picture this collision. And for technical reasons, I can't quite show it to you. But what the video would show is that this is before the collision. You see the two nuclei coming towards each other. They are both moving at very high velocity, close to the speed of light. So they are Lorentz contracted. They are not spheres, but pancakes. And in this model, they collide, they produce an initial state, and then there is a phase transition to a fluid state, which expands and then freezes out into hadrons again. So there are more or less three stages: the initial state, then there is this fluid stage, and then the hadron formation. And I'll discuss all of them briefly in this presentation. So we start from the initial state. And I want to now draw your attention to the azimuthal shape of the initial collision region, because this is an important tool for us to understand the properties of the plasma. And so this is a sketch of two beam particles. One is coming towards you, the other one is going into the screen. And you see that there is a, if they are not quite head on, like here, which we call a semi-central collision, there's an interaction zone in the middle, which is a more or less an oval. But we know that the nuclei are not smooth spheres. They actually contain nucleons. They contain protons and neutrons, which if you draw from a randomly from a distribution, you get this kind of collection of circles for the locations for the protons and neutrons. And what you immediately see is that that leads to a very irregular shape of the interaction region. So it's not just an ellipse. It's an ellipse with many protrusions and dense and less dense areas. And this we can characterize, this shape, we can characterize with azimuthal harmonics. But the first harmonic is the elliptic harmonic. It is a shape that has a long and a short axis. But if you look closely, there are higher harmonics. For example, there's a triangular harmonic, which is this green one, which kind of aligns with this protrusion. And then there's even a fourth order, and you can even go to higher orders. And this is of interest because now what happens is, if this is the initial state, if this gets transformed by the collision into a density profile in space that sits in a vacuum, and there are pressure gradients between the middle and the outer surface, which are different in the long and in the short directions of this collision zone. So what happens is that the droplet, the matter, starts to expand. And it expands faster in this case, in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction on the screen. And that leads to an anisotropy in momentum space. So higher expansion is higher velocity and higher momenta. And that is what we can measure with our detectors. Now, to illustrate that, I'm showing here on the upper right now the azimuthal distribution of all charged particles from a single collision. So this is one collision that we took many years ago. And even in a single event, you see a clear structure. And the structure, maybe at first you think it looks random, but the deviations from uniformity are significant, and they can be analyzed with the same type of azimuthal harmonics that I just discussed. And they are actually drawn in the picture, the red and the green, and there's a dash blue, which are the first few harmonics. Now, of course, to do this with more precision, what we do is we take many events and we sum them up, and then you get these type of pictures. So then you don't look at the angle directly, but at the azimuthal angle differences between two particles or more particles. And you see immediately that there is a very complicated structure, but which has clearly these azimuthal harmonics. So there's the second harmonic and the third harmonic, which leads to these three peaks, and you analyze it. In detail, you see that even the fourth harmonic has a contribution, and even the higher harmonics. So now this, I hope, illustrates really how this is a signature of this process in the collision. But what we normally report at conferences are then the coefficients of these harmonic decompositions as a function of transverse momentum, so the momentum of the particles going away from the beam. And this V2 is the second order so the elliptic coefficient. And you see here, you see this measured for several particles from a paper where we collected much information. And you see that one characteristic thing that you see is that there's this steep increase at low momentum. And as a function of the mass, so when you go from pions to kaons to protons and lambdas, which increases the mass, you see that this increase kind of takes off at higher momentum. And that is actually consistent with a common flow field. If you have a fluid with a common velocity and you produce heavy and light particles, the heavier particles will have a higher momentum than the light particles. So that is exactly what we see here. And what we can, you know, we can do much more sophisticated modeling, but this is the simple picture. And we can do this measurement with light flavor hadrons, but also with heavy flavor hadrons like open charm. And we see actually a very similar pattern. This steep increase is in the range where we don't have many data points yet, but then you see the same kind of bump and a decrease at high momentum. And we can measure these, the higher harmonics, the V3 and the V4 are here given on the right as an example. So now how do we use this to turn this into knowledge about the plasma? So one of the elements that we can actually get from a fit to this data is the viscosity. How is this process sensitive to the viscosity? I would like to illustrate here with a model calculation where here on the left, you see an initial state. You see this lumpy initial conditions where when you, after the collision, you have hot spots and cold spots and it is in this case more or less a circle. And then when you let that expand in a hydrodynamical model, then you get here on the upper right. So this is a picture, a snapshot of such a model calculation. You see it looks similar, but it is a little smoother. It still has a lot of fine structure. And that is what happens if there's no viscosity. But if there is a finite viscosity in these kind of, this is a dimensionless way of quoting the viscosity, eta over S over the entropy density. And at this value, you see that the final state or the state after a short while becomes much smoother. So that means that the higher harmonics get damped by the kind of the friction inside the liquid. And so that is exactly how we can learn about the viscosity from the measurement. And in practice, the way our theory colleagues have done that is, for example, like this. So these are a collection of measurement, the yields, the number of particles, the mean PT, the mean transverse momentum, and then these flow cumulants V3, V2, V3, and V4 as a function, in this case, of centrality. So looking at collisions that are head-on and that are semi-central, as I sketched earlier. And then what they do is they run a model, and the model has many parameters, and they generate a whole bunch of curves for all these parameter settings, and they compare them to the data, and then using Bayesian inference, you can determine which of these model settings are consistent with the data, and that is what you see here at the bottom. So these are the model settings that are found to be consistent with the measurements. And from that, you then, of course, extract properties of the medium. And this is a sample from that analysis of things that you constrain with the data. So here on the left is a picture that shows that in this fit, they constrain at the same time some aspects of the initial state geometry. So they find that this parameter P has to be close to zero to satisfy the data. And that means that the configurations are more like this and less like this and like this. So there's a kind of continuum of initial state models that was probed. And maybe more interestingly, the properties of the plasma itself are the viscosities. So one is the shear viscosity here shown as a function of temperature. And you see that it's a very small value. This 0.1 is close to the quantum mechanical limit for the lowest viscosities that you can have while still satisfying the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And you see that we're very close, and there's a slight increase starting from the phase transition temperature as you go up. And the bottom panel shows the bulk viscosity, which is also extracted, although, as you see, it has a much larger uncertainty at this time because it's the data are less sensitive to that. So now we've measured the viscosity of the plasma, and to put this into context, in the same paper, they compare to some well-known liquids like water, where they, on the horizontal axis, there is the temperature over the critical temperature. So this is water at the liquid gas phase transition. And you see a characteristic decrease and increase, same for helium. And you see that the Coriolis plasma is all the way down here. So it has a very, very low viscosity. And perhaps somewhat counterintuitive, a low viscosity means a short mean free path. So it means actually that there are many interactions between the constituents in the octoplasma. That's given here by this. This is just kinematic physics. So the viscosity is proportional to the mean free path. Low viscosity, low mean free path, many interactions. So we now know that the plasma, the Coriolis plasma, has a very many internal interactions, but behaves like an almost perfect fluid. Now, what I just sketched for you is a development that has been taking place over the last 10 or 20 years. And I just wanted to give you one more recent measurement in this field. So we are still chipping away at understanding these models and how the what they tell us. And this is a recent measurement where we look at the correlation between the orientations of the elliptic and the triangular deformation. So you can look at the by analyzing fluctuations, you can look at the angular distribution between those two. And you see here in the middle the main result, which are these correlations. And you see then other measurement in the black points, which showed a fairly large correlation, which is not very intuitive, because in this ellipse, there is no obvious triangular deformation. So you expect that the orientation can be any way and is therefore uncorrelated. And then it turns out that the old measurement was rather sensitive to numerical fluctuations in the method, and the new measurement that we show here in the red points actually shows that there is no strong correlation between these orientations. And that is also in line with theory calculations that you see here on the right. So that's just to give you a flavor of the type of new measurements that are still happening in this field. So now I would like to switch gear a little bit and think about what happens after this expansion phase. And as I mentioned, then we go back and there's hadrons are formed. And one way to analyze this transition from the Coriolis plasma fluid to the hadrons is by looking just at the amounts of different particles. And here on the right, you see measurements of all kinds of different particles, and the number that has been produced, it is drawn here on the vertical axis, and it's compared to a very simple model for particle production, the so-called thermal model or statistical hadronization model, where basically the number of a type of a certain kind of particle is just proportional to e to the minus m. M is the mass of the particle over a characteristic temperature. And it turns out that all these particle yields follow that pattern very closely. If you put in a temperature of 155 mega electron volts, which is about 10 to the 12 Kelvin. And this is actually exactly where we expect the phase transition temperature to be in the plot that I showed you at the start. So this suggests that in these collisions, what we call the chemical composition, so the types of particles, are mostly determined right when the QGP changes into hadrons, and that has a characteristic temperature of 155 MeV. Now, of course, the collision doesn't stop there. The system continues expanding, and the densities are still quite high. So we do have evidence of rescattering in the hadronic phase, and that comes from measurements with resonances. So here, on the left, I show you a sketch just to give you a feeling for the types of processes. So these are resonances that decay strongly. So their decay time is of the order of a femtometer over sieve. So it's on the same order of magnitude as the lifetime of the system. And then they produce two hadrons often. And then there are two types of processes that can happen. On the one hand, the decay daughters can scatter with other particles in the hadron gas, and then you lose the signal. So you don't see the correlation of the decay anymore. And you can have regeneration where two particles hit each other, form a resonance, and then decay. And it turns out that this rescattering is actually the dominant process. And you can see that here on the right, where we have the yields of a number of selected resonances as a function of the system size. On the left is proton-proton, on the right is lead-lead collisions. And we divide by a similar non-resonant production channel. So rho over pi on K star over K on lambda star over lambda and phi over K on. And you see that the short-lived resonances, you go from small to large systems, the yield is actually suppressed. So you some of these resonance states are lost. And this means that for the long-lived particle like this phi, there is no such suppression because most of them propagate through the hadronic phase as a phi and only then decay. And this sets the hadronic phase lifetime at several femtometer over C. So there can be several interactions in that period. And so there's an interesting second way to look at this, not via resonances, but via other particles. And light nuclei are particularly sensitive because light nuclei like deuterons and tritium and helium-3 and helium-4 are actually produced at the LHC in hadronic collisions. And we produce as many nuclei as antinuclei. So we have a quite abundant source of, for example, anti-helium-4, even in proton-proton collisions. And what is a bit puzzling at the moment, and I'd like to discuss that a bit for you, is the fact that on the one hand, these nuclei have a very small, or some of them have a very small binding energy of the order of MeV, which is much less than the temperature of the hadronic phase. So you expect a large breakup probability. But on the counter side, you may also get coalescence. You might get formation by protons and neutrons which fly around in this hadronic phase and they find each other and they form a hadron. And this is actually one of the places where Wigner also touched our field. So we, when we calculate this process, we use coalescence models. And these coalescence models are based on the Wigner formalism, which actually is exactly the same paper that we saw this morning for the quantum optics. And here on the right, you see a first, one of the ways we analyze this in ELIS. So if you think of deuteron formation in a very naive way, you would think that the deuteron yield is proportional to the proton yield times the neutron yield. And this B2 is just the ratio of the deuteron divided by the proton and neutron yields. And in a very simple picture, that would then be constant. That would be a property of the deuteron wave function as a function of PT. And what we find is that it actually has a slight PT dependence. It turns out that if you do a more careful modeling with full proton-proton collisions generated by the Spithia model or by EPOS, and you then put on top of that a coalescence model, you can actually very nicely reproduce this increase of the B2 as a function of momentum. And so why do we use Wigner functions in this formalism? I'm not a theorist, so apologies if I butcher this. But my understanding, as we also heard this morning, is that the Wigner function is a kind of a trick to treat quantum mechanics both in coordinate space and in momentum space. And that's exactly what you need for this coalescence model, because you have not only, so particles to find each other have to be close in coordinate space, but also in momentum space. And of course, this cannot really be interpreted as a simultaneous probability. So it's a very tricky formalism, which goes also in our field by the quantum density matrix formalism name. And this was explored for nuclei by these authors, Uri Heinz and Scheibel, and probably a lot more people. And it has then been extended already more than 10 years ago by some of the people here in the room, like Peter Levi and many of his colleagues here, but has been picked up in Italy and in the US and in many places as an interesting idea for hadron formation, for how partons form hadrons. And yeah, let me just go there immediately. That one of the strongest evidence that we have that this is really relevant comes from the JPSI state. So we measure the production of JPSI mesons, which are a bound state of a quark, a charm quark, and a charm antiquark. And initially, the motivation for these measurements is that if you have a CC bar pair in a quark gluon plasma, and it at certain temperatures, when there's a screening, there's a Debye screening. So if the two are sitting in the plasma, but the density of plasma is very high around, the charges don't see each other anymore. They see the thermal charges, but not the the counterpart, and this leads to melting or dissociation of J psi mesons. And that is what we see at high transverse momentum at the LHC. So we see here that if we divide the yields of J psi in nucleus-nucleus collision by those in proton-proton collisions, we see very large suppression by about a factor 5. And that is this dissociation effect. But at lower energies, we did not have this, but at LHC, we actually have so many charm and anti-charm quarks that we also see a regeneration effect. We see that at low momenta, where the densities of these charm quarks are higher, actually the suppression is not as large as it is at high momentum. And it depends on rapidity. At mid rapidity, 90 degrees of the colliding beams, the increase is larger than at forward rapidity. And this again, one can model in more detail. So I just to show you that it's not all qualitative, but there is actually quantitative analysis. I showed the same results in mid rapidity REA and the forward rapidity REA together with model curves, which include this coalescence. And they capture this increase at low transverse momentum, which comes from this coalescence of quarks into J psi mesons. So now that was going a little bit back and forth through the QGP phase and then to the final state and coming back to this melting effect. Now, before coming a bit more to the experimental side, I wanted to mention one more probe that is very important for us, which is to measure directly the temperature of the quark gluon plasma. And to measure the temperature, I showed you earlier, if we measure with hadronic probes, if we measure particle yields, we measure a temperature of 155 MeV, which is the phase transition temperature. So to measure the temperature before the phase transition, you have to use particles that do not interact with the plasma and that are produced throughout the evolution of the collision. And those are electromagnetic probes. So those are direct photons, or as you will later see, electron-positron pairs. And here on the right, you see the transverse momentum spectrum of photons measured by Alice. This is a very challenging measurement because photons are not only produced directly as radiation from the collision, but also by decays of pi zeros and etas. So we have to subtract those from the measurement. And then there are two sets of processes that you can think of. One is hard scattering. So there is radiation that happens in the initial state and that you see at very high transverse momentum. And that's the black line here is the calculation of that. But then at low momenta, you see an excess above this expectation. And those are the thermal radiation. So you can analyze, you can subtract the hard scattering photons and you can analyze the thermal excess here on the left, and you see that it is more or less exponential, which is what you would expect for thermal radiation. And then on the right, I'm showing the slope, so the exponential slope of the spectra. And you see that they are in the range of 300 to 400 MeV, so much higher than the 150 mega electron volts that I mentioned before. But there's also significant uncertainty depending on which part of the spectrum you exactly look at. And the way to go beyond that is actually with E plus E minus pairs, which is one of the main goals of the upcoming heavy ion runs. So with that, I would like to briefly go back to our instrumentation, to what does our detector look like and what do we plan for the future. So this is the LS detector now shown as a kind of as a sketch. And you recognize this middle part, which is cylindrical around the beams with many different detector technologies. And then here, the forward part with this muon arm with an absorber that removes all the hadrons that I mentioned before. And the special feature of this detector is that it can measure these very large densities of particles that I showed to you in the event display. And that we have several techniques for doing particle identification in the time projection chamber, the blue volume, but also using these detectors on the outside, the TRD, time of flight, and electromagnetic calorimeters. Now, I will not go into detail for those things. If you want a lecture on experimental particle physics, we can come back to that some other time. But I wanted to point out to you that, or to remind you that in Alice, we have just installed a major set of upgrades. So during the long shutdown, the past long shutdown of the LHC, 2019 to 2021, we replaced some of our detectors. Like the inner tracking system now is fully instrumented with pixel detectors. We have 12 billion pixels looking at the interaction point. And the time projection chamber, we installed new readout chambers with gem foils, and they were actually, some of them were tested here in the laboratory. And the goal of this is to be able to read out the detector much faster. So we also have a big online event processing farm to deal with all this data. And that means that we can now collect about 50 times more heavy ion collisions, 50 kilohertz, so 50,000 collisions per second, and 10 times more trigger data. And as I mentioned, one of the goals of that is to measure that this thermal radiation with electron-positron pairs. Now, while we are just about to start taking data, we have some future upgrades that I wanted to just briefly mention. So in 5 years from now, what we plan to do is we want to replace the innermost layers of our inner tracking system with a new generation of pixel sensors, very intricate design where we thin the sensors, which are made of silicon, and by making them about 50 micron thick, you can actually bend the silicon wave where it becomes almost paper-like. And that allows us to make these kind of half shells. These are silicon wafers without electronics on them, but these are real silicon wafers that are curved. And they can look at the interaction point with very little supporting material. So very low material budget. They don't interfere with the particles coming out of the plasma. And that improves again the pointing resolution, which is important for heavy flavor and lepton measurements. And a second upgrade that we're constructing is a forward calorimeter that covers the forward angle with for measurements of direct photons to look actually at the initial phases at the gluon content of the nucleus. And then in 10 years from now, we have a more ambitious upgrade. So we have a kind of a cycle of small and large upgrades. So the next large upgrade is the so-called LS3 upgrade, where we replace the whole detector system with a very large silicon tracker that has an even better pointing resolution. It has this inner tracker, which is retractable, which can be brought close to the interaction point so that you have the first detection at 5 millimeters from the interaction point. And it can be retracted when we put in the beams into the machine. And then we have with the new detector, we plan to have a coverage up to a rapidity of 4, so to be able to measure charged particles over a large angle, also along the beam. And then there's a number of particle identification systems, including an electromagnetic calorimeter, again, a time of flight system, also instrumented with silicon, and muon chambers with an absorber at the outside, this time also covering the mid-rapidity part of the detector. So and to give you a sense of these of the measurements that are coming up, I'm showing you here the dilepton mass spectrum. So this is the, as a function of mass, the rate of pairs of electron-positron pairs. You see some structure which comes from different resonances. Up to the J-psi, and then between these resonances, we have this range, which is very nicely exponential, which is where thermal radiation is actually very apparent. So the slope of the spectrum here is a direct measure of the temperature of the early stages of the collision. And the nice thing of this is that it, on the one hand, by going to this mass range, you naturally reject all these resonance contributions, which is important, and they also contribute to the photons that I showed earlier. And by measuring as a function of mass, you have a Lorentz invariant quantity, which gives more direct access to the temperature in the rest frame without having to worry about local boosts of the system. Now, and just to give you a flavor of the precision with which we can do that, you see here on the left, you see the measurement that we plan to do. This is a projection now, the precision of the measurement in the coming years. So with the current upgrade and this ITS3 upgrade. And then in the middle, you see the same measurement as projected for the LS3 timeframe. So the new detector 10 years from now, you see the much improved precision. And you see this zooms in on a range here where we are sensitive to rho A1 mixing, which is a signature of chiral symmetry restoration, which is a very fundamental aspect of this phase transition and the hadronic phase properties. And with that high statistics, you can also do more differential measurements, so you can measure the V2, this azimuthal anisotropy that I discussed in the past, for thermal radiation for dielectrons. Now, another type of measurement that I just wanted to briefly flash that is also for the future are these measurements where we use charm quarks and anti-charm quarks, which are produced back to back in the initial hard scattering. And we look at the azimuthal angle between them to, which is a very sensitive probe of interactions between these heavy quarks with the plasma. As they go through, they get scattered. And this away side peak, so the 180 degree peak, is broadened. And here you see a theory calculation of that. And on the right, you see a projection with this LS3 detector of the precision with which we can measure CC bar pairs, which is very challenging. They have a very large background. And for example, in the upcoming round 3 and 4, even though we have a very nice detector, this is the precision that we expect. So there's really still a jump to be made in the precision of these measurements and in the way we can analyze this quark-gluon plasma. And to do that, we are already starting to do detector R&D. And for this LS3 upgrade, we are looking at the vertex tracker mechanics. I mentioned that we have this concept of a retractable tracker, which you see here, first mechanical mock-ups of this retractable structure. There's a lot of silicon tracker sensor development ongoing, both for this ITS3 and for the future LS3. And you see here some pictures of that. And then there are other sensor developments, both on the silicon side for time of flight, for particle identification, but also, for example, for this muon detector, where we need to instrument a large area with low noise detectors. So with that, I would like to conclude. So I gave you a somewhat whirlwind overview of what we do with how we study strongly interacting matter, the solid state physics of strong interacting matter with ALIS, and how we get to the properties of the quark-gluon plasma. And I explained how we can infer the shear viscosity, which is very low, from our data, from looking at these azimuthal anisotropies, that we found that also heavy quarks actually flow with this liquid. And that indicates that we have a very short mean free path. So there's a strong residual interactions in the plasma. And in the future, we plan to refine some of this by measuring the initial temperature, which is already in reach for the upcoming runs. And then also to use these heavy flavor quarks to get a more fine understanding of how the system approaches thermal equilibrium via the interactions. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for the excellent talk. Maybe we have time for a question. There's any.
When you talk about the distribution of the particles created, you had an exponential law, Boltzmann factor, but the prefactor was 2j plus 1. What is 2j plus 1?
This is a very good question. 2j plus 1 is the number of, let's say, spin degrees of freedom. So it's the, if you have a spin 1 particle, it is, I'm making a mistake. It's one of the internal degrees of freedom. So it's the number of states that you have for each of these particles. It should be 2 for spin 1/2 and 3 for spin 1 and so on. Yeah. So which was.
There was one more question over here.
So in the last part, you showed about the dielectron. You showed the dielectron spectrum, and you mentioned that the open charm decay is measuring the temperature. So is there some argument for that, or is simply exponential and then?
Yeah, so this part, that's a very good question. Sorry, I wasn't very clear there. So in this mass range, you have the thermal spectrum, but you also have, especially at LHC, large contributions from heavy flavor, which are indicated as DD bar and BB bar. And those are backgrounds for the temperature measurement. And in fact, you want to reject them by doing by looking at the point of origin at the DCA of the particles. And some of the improvements between this one and this one actually come from the ability to better subtract the heavy flavor. So it's actually not the heavy flavor ones that give the temperature. Yeah.
Thank you very much. There's one more duty. Thank you very much for the talk. So let's thank the speakers. So if you allow, I would like to congratulate the speaker, and we will be handing over the Wigner Medal. I will not try to open it, just causes some issues, for this talk, as thank you, being so grateful. So thank you very much.